Hello, I'm Evan Brand. Welcome back to the podcast. Let's dive in and talk about some birds. Man, I got some good feedback from you all. Thank you. You know, I do so many things on the show and then nobody says anything. So I'm like, do people enjoy that? And when I talked about birds, everyone's like, wow, this is great. Do more birds. Okay, so let's do more birds. I'm going to play you some sounds. I tell you, it's really, really fun this time of the year because things change so quickly in the woods. And if you live near the woods, things change so quickly if you pay attention. See, most people don't pay attention. They got headphones in their ears all the time, which is fine because maybe you're listening to me on headphones. That's a good use of headphones. But, you know, I try to listen to the natural world and not miss out on stuff. And over the last 6 weeks or so, the sounds have changed rapidly and significantly compared to the sounds of winter and early spring before anything really got moving. So I'll play you some sounds and then we'll talk about what we've been hearing because things are moving and we've got a lot of new seasonal visitors to at least this part of North America. Okay, that's a hard one. I bet 99% of you are not going to know that one. So that's a red-headed woodpecker, which is different than the red-bellied woodpecker. A lot of people think the red-bellied woodpeckers are red-headed. It's not. Totally different. The red-headeds are awesome. They need dead trees to survive, and their beaks did not evolve to be as hard and rigid as other woodpeckers. So their softer beak requires softer, more dead trees to actually make a cavity to nest and find food. So we're lucky that we've got some dead ash trees around here where we see red-headed woodpeckers literally every day. So they've been around here, so they're not a new visitor, but they're so much fun I had to mention them. All right, let's move on. See if you know this one. A lot of you should know this one. Okay, that's easy. If you know anything about bobwhite quails, that's awesome. We had one on our fence post this morning, and I've got about 1 acre that I tilled up that we're turning into a wildflower patch. And so maybe he's scoping it out because they're starting to get long. So maybe he's scoping it out. You know, bobwhite quails have declined so much over the last 50 years because of the way we've changed farming. Small family farms are no longer and big corporate farms have taken over, and therefore the brushy edge of a farm is where they need to survive. They need that big thick brush to survive and to raise their young, and everyone has perfectly manicured lawns now. Even if you have 5, 10, 20 acres, people, they cut it all and there's just no room, there's no space, there's no habitat for the bobwhite quail. So they're in big trouble, but we are seeing some resurgence in Kentucky at least with bobwhites. And hey, we heard one in our backyard, so that's good. All right, let's move on. This is the summer tanager, and obviously with the name summer, they come in the summer. I believe they come from South America. I don't know exactly what part. They look like a really skinny cardinal, maybe slightly smaller, but definitely more thin, kind of like a cardinal on a ketogenic diet maybe. You know, they are very, very beautiful, very bright, almost a little more orange than red. And they're awesome. So we had a summer tanager. He was at the top of the tree right by our pond, and he was just watching out, you know, calling for females. So okay, so that's the yellow-billed cuckoo. They are amazing. They're also a seasonal visitor. They come from South America. I want to say Colombia, but I'm not 100% sure on that. I found cuckoos a couple years ago in the woods. That's normally where you find them, typically near the top of the trees. You're never going to see them coming to a bird feeder, obviously. Never going to see them on the ground. But yellow-billed cuckoos are really cool. There's an app you should probably have if you're into birds at all. It's from the Cornell Ornithology. It's just called Merlin Bird ID. So you can look that up and you can type in, where did you see the bird? What's the size of it? What was the date you saw it? What were the colors? And it's extremely accurate. And so that way you can find the map. And I'm looking at the map now, the yellow-billed cuckoo. Looks like they're all over South America, all through Brazil. So they're a rainforest bird. So they like our woods around here, though, in the summer. Okay, that's the last one. Then we'll get into this interview. So that's the Baltimore Oriole. They're already gone. By the time I even have time to talk about them, they're already gone. They came over to our Oriole feeder where we set out some jelly and we set out some oranges. Yes, they were organic. We take care of our birds. So I read something the other day that was talking about robins and how a lot of these bird rescue people are having robins that are really sick with pesticides because all these people are spraying their yards with glyphosate and other chemicals. And of course, guess what? That goes into the soil, into the worms. The robins eat the worms that are filled with pesticides, and now all these robins are sick and poisoned. So just crazy. Another reason not to use those chemicals on your yard. Please don't. Please don't. For the bees, for the butterflies, for the robins, for yourself, for your kids. Don't do that. There's other ways. And just let the dandelions grow. They're beautiful and they have benefits. So don't get rid of dandelions. Don't spray chemicals to kill yourself and your family and the ecosystem. We already have 300 million pounds per year being sprayed of glyphosate on the USA lands right now. So we don't need any extra. You know, we see those guys on their driveway in flip-flops spraying their Roundup. It's like, dude, stop. What are you doing? You really care that much about grass growing through the crack of your driveway? So what? Anyhow, that's my rant about glyphosate. Let's get into the show, though. This is an interview I thought I published, but I did not publish. So I was part of the Toxic Mold Summit. And this was honestly, you know, during the time of this recording, I was just barely getting into learning about mold and all the different things going on. So this talk was really more about candida because we find that mold exposure actually promotes candida. And so now I know why I see so many people with candida overgrowth. Then we look at their mold in their house or their mold in their body, and they have tons. So it all makes sense now. So I've learned so much since this interview, but this is with Dr. Margaret Christensen. She's a medical doc out of Texas, really, really wonderful woman, and I was grateful that she had me on her summit. You can actually access tons of other talks on this thing for free. If you just type in evanbrand.com/mold, you can go on your phone or whatever, register for that summit. It's already over, but you can get 7 days free access using that link to check out other talks. All right, so here is the show with Dr. Margaret Christensen and I talking about toxic mold, candida, symptoms, etc. Enjoy. If you want to reach out, you can do that at my website, evanbrand.com. I work with people around the world. Okay, here we go.
Well, welcome. This is Dr. Margaret Christensen at Carpathia Collaborative in Dallas. And my guest today is Evan Brand, who is an author, a podcast host, and a Louisville, Kentucky-based board-certified holistic nutritionist. He's a certified functional medicine practitioner, a nutritional therapist, and a personal trainer. He's really passionate about healing the chronic fatigue, obesity, and depression epidemics that we're seeing after solving his own IBS and depression issues, and we'll be talking about those, his story. He uses at-home lab testing and customized supplement programs to find and fix the root cause of a wide range of health symptoms. He has the Not Just Paleo podcast, which has over 6 million downloads and counting. He's the author of Stress Solutions, REM Rehab, and the Everything Guide to Nootropics. And he offers free 15-minute functional medicine phone consultations at his site, evanbrand.com. And very recently, this past year, he's also hosted the Candida Summit, and that's really what we're going to be talking and focusing on today. So welcome, Evan.
Thank you for having me. Yeah. I changed the name of my podcast since that bio was written. Okay. So it's now called The Evan Brand Show. So if you just type in Evan Brand Podcast, that'll be the best way to find me.
Okay, well, great. Well, like all the different practitioners and nutritionists and coaches that we've interviewed, you have your own story in terms of how you got into this whole systems integrative functional approach. So why don't we start there, and then we'll talk about the whole challenge of candida as a comorbidity in this whole toxic mold phenomenon.
Sure. Well, as you and I were kind of talking off air, you know, you believe that antibiotics are something that can lead to the downfall to a lot of these people, whether it's mold issues or candida or parasites or bacterial overgrowth or fungal overgrowth. I think that was part of my story as well. I wasn't the typical kid that was getting tubes in their ears and endless rounds of antibiotics, but I definitely remember, you know, drinking down that terrible pink liquid antibiotic as a kid. And started to get used to the taste, which meant I was probably getting too many antibiotics. And so, of course, that leads into further issues as you get into your teenage years with acne. And I had gut issues along with it. Went to the conventional doctors, got diagnosed with IBS, which means your gut's not right, but we have no clue what's wrong with your gut. So we're just going to write you this prescription for an acid blocking medication as well as an antispasmatic drug, and we're going to send you on the way. If that's not good enough, then we can send you to the gastro doc, and then you can go get an endoscopy, which could potentially infect you with some type of bacteria or fungus because they didn't clean it very well from the last person they stuck it down. So then you leave the hospital to get a routine procedure and you leave with an infection. Luckily, I didn't do any of that. I didn't do prescriptions. I didn't do the scope. I did do the barium x-ray scan to try to figure out my gut issues. There was no information from that. It was a waste of time. So then I ended up becoming a nutritionist first and basically using food as medicine. You know, I had heard that thing preached to me for so long and I thought, okay, let's try this food as medicine thing out. I got maybe 60% better. So brain fog was better. Depression was significantly better. Anxiety was much better. Sleep was better. My skin was better, but I was still not out of the woods. And so that's when a friend of mine called Dr. Justin. We do a lot of podcasts together. He looked at me. Now, this was when I lived down in Austin, Texas. And he looked at me and he said, Evan, he goes, I think you've got a parasite. And I was like, how so? And he said, well, in your old pictures, you look like you had more muscle. And he said, now you look like your muscle's getting robbed off your bones. He's like, you probably got an infection. I'm like, okay, let me check it out. And so I ran some functional stool testing and turns out I had cryptosporidium and giardia, as well as H. pylori, as well as candida, as well as bacterial overgrowth. I mean, I had like a quintuple whammy. So my gut was a wreck. And after several rounds of herbs, I did not use drugs. I just did botanicals. I finally cleared out all these infections I probably had for 15 years. I retested to ensure the infections were gone. And then now all my symptoms are gone. My skin's better. My mood's better. Everything's better. And I still just do a checkup, you know, once or twice a year. I just sent off some urine last week to look for candida and look at toxic chemicals. And I continue to do like a once a year checkup with functional labs. But beyond that, I'm kind of out of the woods now. So I just help people do the same thing that I did for myself. And I think when you suffer, I think it makes you more empathetic. I think it makes you a better practitioner when you know where people came from. So I can kind of empathize with the people that are listening to this. I know what it's like. And when you're desperate, you're going to go to the conventional rabbit hole. But I got to tell you, that's not going to solve your answers. You know, these Diflucans and fluconazole and all these other pharmaceuticals, maybe they have a role. I don't know. I cannot prescribe them with my credentials. But what I'll say is, most of the people who get to me, they've already done that and it didn't work, which is why we're trying something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's you made just some really important points, and with your history, is so common. One of the things from a functional standpoint that we all do is take a really good antibiotic history and see, okay, how many antibiotics have you been in over a lifetime? What a lot of practitioners don't realize is that underlying why you got the antibiotics in the first place, if it's chronic sinus infections, fungal infections, strep throat, recurrent ear infections as a kid, recurrent bronchitis and upper respiratory infections, oftentimes that is because you've had some mold exposure that your body is reacting to. You're getting infections from that. Then you get put on the antibiotics, and now you've disrupted your microbiome and gotten fungal overgrowth. And we're going to talk about that. So what, again, kind of what are your approaches? And let's start at kind of what is candida? What is it?
Yeah, so candida is a yeast, and it's an opportunistic yeast. And so generally, it can stay in a relatively healthy balance along with the other guys in the gut. Candida is something that we don't necessarily need to strive to eliminate completely. Mm-hmm. It's something that we want to coexist peacefully with. But anytime there's a nuclear bomb thrown into the gut, which in this case, we're talking about antibiotics being a big one for people, whether they get a routine dental procedure done or a root canal. I mean, it could be anything. It could be these slippery slopes lurking everywhere. People are like, oh, I haven't had antibiotics. And then you're like, well, you said you had a root canal. Mm-hmm. Did you get antibiotics then? Oh, I sure did. Mm-hmm. So some people forget, I mean, because these things are passed out like candy. And when that happens, the first guy to move back into the neighborhood or become opportunistic is the yeast, the candida. And there's over 20 different species of it. We still don't even know. When I say we, I'm not studying species of candida. I just work on eradicating and fixing the levels of candida. But scientists and researchers are looking for more and more strains. The ones we most commonly see are called Candida SPP and Candida albicans. Albicans, SPP is a little harder to kill than albicans. Albicans a little easier to kill, at least in my experience. And you could have both. Mm-hmm. You could have one or the other. But the interesting thing is, rarely is it just candida by itself. As you mentioned, it could have been mold that led to the antibiotic use, which then led to candida. So now you've got mold and candida to work on. Or in my case, it was candida plus bacteria plus parasites. And now, the past year or two, DNA testing has come out for worms. So now I'm even seeing people with whipworm and hookworm and beef tapeworm and pork tapeworm. I'm seeing all sorts of worms. You can't even believe it. I'm seeing people, which you mentioned some of my friends and colleagues on here, Todd and Jay Davidson are speaking on your event as well. You know, with some of the stuff that all three of us guys are working on, I mean, we're seeing people poop out 1 foot long, 2 foot long worms. Mm-hmm. While doing a candida protocol. So sometimes you never know what you're going to get until you just start working on this stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's really amazing. And you're so right that there's, again, multiple different layers, and we've spoken to those on different pieces of this summit of trying to kind of go after and attack all the different layers. What is the type of testing that you like to do to identify molds and candida and fungus, which...
My top two tests, number one would be the GI map, mm-hmm. and that's from Diagnostic Solutions. That's a stool test. It's a 1 day, one sample, which mm-hmm. is really convenient because I used to use another company that had antigen-based testing. Mm-hmm. It was less accurate, and it took 3 days of collecting poop, which mm-hmm. nobody wants to do. This one's 1 day, one sample, and it's insanely accurate. Now, mm-hmm. I will tell you, it's very rare to see candida show up on the stool. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that means you're not pooping out the yeast. I'm not sure if the detection method's not as good or what, but more commonly I lean towards the organic acids test. Mm-hmm. I use Great Plains. A lot of people use Genova. I just mm-hmm. happen to like Great Plains better because mm-hmm. what I do is I'll take the urine and I'll run it through either one, two, or three different machines at their lab. So one is the organic acids. You wake up, you collect the first morning urine sample. We're going to look for several indicators. We're going to look for one called arabinose, which is the gas that candida produces. That way you can prove that it's there. Mm-hmm. You can look for another marker called tartaric acid. You can look for another marker called citric acid. Mm-hmm. And there's another one called tricarbolic. There's probably 5 or 10, give or take, different markers. Some actually indicate mold. Some mm-hmm. indicate fungus. Some indicate other types of yeast. It's the whole first page almost of the organic acids through Great Plains that shows this. And also, you know, we'll test for Clostridia because I find a lot of people with mold, candida issues, they may also have Clostridia infections because we've heard of C. diff before, the Clostridia difficile. People will get this after they go to a hospital, healthcare facility. They may go to a nursing home. They may pick up Clostridia difficile after a round of antibiotics. And this is when you get diarrhea so much that you end up getting dangerously dehydrated. And there's people, you know, generally elderly people that die every single year of C. diff infections. And so we test for all of it. And then what I'll do is I'll have the urine run through another machine, which is called the mycotox panel through Great Plains. And that's how we can look at the okra toxin. The mycotoxin panel is great. You've got the Stachybotrys. I mean, you've got amazing stuff that they can do. So you could see what is the person's level of mycotoxins. And then third is I'll run a toxic chemical test. And this is non-metals. So it's called the GPL tox, TOX. And that one looks at all sorts of stuff. It's probably one of my favorite tests. I mean, it looks for gasoline additives. It looks for xylene, paint, lacquers. It looks for nail polish. It looks for hair dyes. It looks for cosmetics. It looks for styrene. It looks for styrofoam, you know, the chemicals that are used in styrofoam food packaging. It looks for glyphosate and other pesticides. I mean, it is just awesome. So when we do that, then we can kind of set the timeline for people because people always say, okay, is it the chicken or the egg? Or, you know, what do I go after first, right? Like, what's the correct order of operations that leads to success? And what I've tried to do is go after the gut issues first. And then step two, you know, so step one is usually identify and remove the bad guys. Step two is usually heal the gut. Step three is usually focus on the detoxification. Because what I found is, if you ignore these toxic chemicals, you've got high levels of gasoline or whatever else in your body. What I found is that these infections come back. Mm-hmm. So even if they don't do a round of antibiotics, it's almost like, you know, I'm sure some mm-hmm. may mention this, but I'll mention it briefly. Some will say that heavy metals encourage the growth of candida mm-hmm. and other issues. I found that other toxic chemicals can too. So even if it's not aluminum or mercury or other heavy metals, it may just be toxic chemicals in general. Those tend to encourage the overgrowth of bugs as well. So it's kind of like a bucket, and this bucket's full. And when the bucket's full, you get symptoms. And so if you can use your magnifying glass and look into the bucket, you see, okay, candida is 20% of the problem. Mold is 30% of the problem. Adrenals is 20%. Liver is 20%. You know, you just kind of build up your bucket. And then that way you can see, okay, what's the biggest piece of the pie here? Let's go after that. And then, yeah, maybe detox is the answer, but maybe that's not the first answer. But if you talk to a detox specialist, they're going to say detox. That's the number one most important goal. If you talk to a Lyme disease specialist, they're going to say forget mold, focus on Lyme. So some practitioners are biased, and that's fine. I try to be a specialist and a generalist at the same time. It's like, okay, yeah, candida is a huge piece of the puzzle, but it's not everything. And for some people, it may only be 5% of their problem. Another person, it may be 90% of the problem. So I think it's important for practitioners listening not to get too caught up in your own business model and make sure that you're not missing something else important.
I totally agree. And I'm there with you too on the testing. So I will also use the GPL mycotox test as well. That one also carries a zearalenone on it, which is a particularly hormone disrupting toxin. And sometimes I'll use it in combination with Real-Time Labs, which is more expensive, but they have a much more extensive trichothecene panel, whereas GPL only has one. One marker, Real-Time has, I think, 10 markers for the Stachybotrys, you know, really bad black moles. Absolutely, you're right on point about the GPL tox test. It's another really great test looking at the overall body burden. And I really do also like the GPL oat testing. Like you said, there's all those markers. They have like 8-9 different markers, I think, for fungal overgrowth. And I believe it's markers 2, 4, and 5 that if those are elevated can also signal that there may be a toxic mold issue as well. So sounds like you're doing a nice thorough deep dive that using the GI map. We're moving over to using that from some of the other testing that I have had used. And fungus is difficult to show up. And as we talk here about treatment, I know that part of it, we have to break up the biofilm. I think that sometimes, I don't know if this has been your experience, but with my experience, when we start kind of knocking off the candida, the bacterial overgrowth, their fungal markers may not have been very high initially, but then you repeat the oat test, and we made the mistake of ordering that oat test too early in the cycle after 8 weeks instead of at least 12. And oh my gosh, all the markers went way up. And it's like, wow, okay, we've broken open something here and we're releasing. So anyway, fabulous. It sounds like you're doing a really great, comprehensive deep dive to help folks.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on that if I may.
Yeah, sure.
So what you'll often see too with some of the stool testing, especially the GI map, because it is so sensitive, is you may come in, you know, I spoke with a client this morning. Actually, it's going to be pretty fun. It's going to be on my podcast. People have been saying, Evan, why don't you interview a client and put that client interview on the podcast so we can hear from your clients and not just, you know, practitioners. So that'll be on my podcast soon. But what we discuss is that, you know, you come in and your practitioner may say, okay, here's our priorities 1, 2, and 3. For example, let's say bacterial overgrowth and candida. So you go after that. And then, like you said, maybe you retest after 2 or 3 months. Now, all of a sudden, it's completely different. Now you've got more bacteria. You've got new parasites that weren't there before. And now the candida looks like it's off the chart. You're like, well, what the heck? Evan, did you not do a correct protocol? Like, what's your problem? The answer is no. There's nothing we did wrong. It's just that sometimes these things heal in layers. We may have just saw the first layer that we could detect. Now we've scraped the bowl, and now we've revealed all the real bad guys under here. So I may, you know, depending on someone's budget or their timeline, you might as well just go ahead and do a second or third round even of herbs before you even go ahead and retest. Because if you retest, I'm going to tell you to do the same thing anyway, which is, hey, you went down the rabbit hole. We got to keep going. But yeah, you're so right that, you know, sometimes it's a cost thing where maybe they're forced to test only once every 6 months. And in some cases that's better because then that gives us more time to do more work.
Yeah. And you know, the other, I had wanted to also mention that another thing that makes us more susceptible to fungal overgrowth and yeast, et cetera too, is the rampant use of steroids. Again, so you've got bronchitis, or you've even got autoimmune issues, and you're taking a lot of steroids, or using topically, or breathing them in, inhaling them. That's something else that contribute. And I'm sure that's something you asked for in your history. Birth control pills also can make women a little bit more susceptible. Any other medications that you can think off the top of your head that you're looking for?
I would say the acid blocking medications. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I did not know that topical steroids would do that. So mm-hmm. I do ask about steroids, but I was only thinking that oral did something. So you're saying topical actually encourages mold as well?
Yeah. And wow. Just, you know, fungal overgrowth, depending again, how much you're using, how often you're using. Like I've seen these, you know, young women come in who've been using topical cortisone or prednisone cream for years because of bad psoriasis or eczema. And again, that's affecting your adrenal system, and it's going internally. So you can also, those steroids is something else that can definitely affect. And I can't tell you how many people are doing the inhaled steroids and the Flonase up their nose. All of that is also going to increase our fungal burden, because what we need is antifungals.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So,
You know what? That makes perfect sense. My mother-in-law, she has COPD. She believes it was from her years as a cleaner using toxic chemicals. So of course she's on the steroid inhaler, and guess what? She had all these sinus infections. What'd they do? They put her on antibiotics, and she's still using that inhaler. I bet you that inhaler is not helping. It's probably making things worse.
Well, it's interesting. So we're, again, a couple of folks that we've talked to on this summit, Dr. Ann Shippey is going to be talking about sinuses. And I recently had a conversation with a pulmonologist, Dr. Mukesh Saraya, who's in Denton, Texas, who's amazing. And he's doing bronchoscopies on folks who've got COPD, bronchiectasis, recurrent, you know, pulmonary issues, and finding that when he does bronchial washings, that it's all fungal, and he's treating with antifungals and nebulized glutathione instead of using more steroids and antibiotics. So
wow.
That's just another way to approach this.
That's amazing. Well, let me get back to my original point, because I kind of went on a tangent because you blew my mind for a second there. So the acid blocking medications, I think it's important to discuss those, even if it's an over the counter or if it's prescription, either way, because when you're reducing your stomach acid levels, you're encouraging the overgrowth of fungus and other pathogens. Because normally, for example, if we look to nature to help us understand things, look at the turkey vulture, for example. You know, in Kentucky, we've got so many turkey vultures, you wouldn't believe it. And they have the most acidic stomach of any living creature on planet Earth. And their pH is so low, meaning their gut is so acidic, this is how they can go to the side of the road and they can eat roadkill and they cannot get sick from it, because their stomach acid neutralizes all the pathogens in that dead animal. And so for humans, we want a pretty acidic stomach as well. So acidic that if you cut a hole in it, in your stomach, it would burn, hopefully, a hole in your shoe. Now, with acid blocking medications, with stress, with not chewing your food well, with age, I mean, we know with the work of Dr. Jonathan Wright, who wrote a great book called Why Stomach Acid is Good for You, that by age 40, you make less than half of what you made when you were 20 in terms of acid and enzymes that are produced from your parietal cells. Now, if you compound that with an acid blocking drug, or you combine that with an infection like H. pylori, which is something I see and work on every single day of my clients. H. pylori is a bacterial infection that damages the parietal cells, and it reduces your ability to make stomach acid. So the precursor to fungal and other overgrowth could have been just an H. pylori infection, which is something easily passed between each other, you know, kissing, sharing cups and spoons and forks, and hey, try a bite of this. And then you give your friend H. pylori. And that infection is something I had, and I believe that was part of why my candida overgrowth was so bad, because now what happens is your food is rotting and putrefying in the gut. You're not digesting it. Your stools may float, which is indicating you're not digesting your fats well. So people may go on a lower carbohydrate diet, or they may even go to a ketogenic diet to try to help out with weight loss or whatever other goals they have. And they may feel even worse, or the keto diet may not do much for them. And it could be because they can't digest anything because their stomach acid's too low. So you go and try to eat this grass-fed steak, and you're like, well, why do I feel like crap when I eat this, you know, supposedly amazing organic meat? Well, it could be because of the gut. So If you're on or you had a history of being on acid blockers, you really, really have to succeed. You really have to work on getting rid of those. And there are weaning protocols that we could use where we're reducing the dose of the medication as well as upping the dose of supplemental acid and enzymes. Assuming there's no ulcers or major inflammatory issue, it's usually a pretty smooth process.
Absolutely. You really hit a nail on the head. I think that these acid blockers that are available over the counter, people just take them like they're candy and that think it's a good thing and think that acid is bad for them. I'm sure that you have a lot of folks who are complaining about GERD or reflux, the esophageal reflux symptoms. And the answer is not to take more more acid blockers. It actually, the answer is actually to give more acid to close off the sphincter that's creating that reflux. And like you said, yeah, we have a number of protocols that help folks wean off. And it's just amazing what you can do just, again, getting people off their proton pump inhibitors, their PPIs or other reflux meds, because you're right. It affects absorption of all your nutrients. It affects digestion and breakdown of the proteins. It affects activation of the other enzymes within your body. And, you know, you made a really important point that our acid levels in our gut anyway tend to go down over time. Love the turkey vulture story. Never heard that one before. That's totally amazing.
Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. You brought up one other thing. What was it? I was going to hit upon. The acid. The acid could be the problem if you've got a faulty lower esophageal sphincter. You mentioned mm-hmm. the sphincter. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes there's a hiatal hernia or some other like structural problem going on. So, you know, part of my recovery was going to a chiropractor who was able to do a maneuver on me to fix my hiatal hernia, because I was having issues there. So, you know, it may take multiple practitioners in your team. You may have some structural stuff going on. It may be a stress thing. It may be a faulty sphincter. You need more acid and enzymes. It could be H. pylori. So you've just got to do a really good job of turning over as many rocks as you can to try to get to the solutions here. It's not just one silver bullet. It's more of a silver shotgun. And you just blast the pellets everywhere into these categories.
You know, you made some really great points. And I love what you mentioned about chiropractic and using that to help with hiatal hernias and just also what we know that various levels on the spine, you have the nerves coming out that are innervating the esophagus, the mouth, the gastrointestinal tract, and getting adjustments in those areas can make a huge difference. I would encourage when babies are born that you take to your baby. You may want to take them to a chiropractor who works with babies and infants to help with that adjustment coming out of the birth canal or through C-sections, because that compression is something else that can contribute. So many babies are now being diagnosed with reflux and they're being put on PPIs
from the start,
which is just appalling. When we can use probiotics and beautiful little teeny tiny craniosacral type work and adjustments. So thank you for bringing that up. That's super, super important.
Can I hit on this?
Because
you brought up something great, which is children. You know, I was not trained as a pediatric functional medicine guy, but I've started to work with more and more children. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because no one is providing solutions. I mean, these pediatricians out there, even if they're, you know, considered a functional pediatrician, they're still putting these children with colic on Zantac, which is an acid blocker. So, you know, I've had to, and I've got a 2-year-old daughter myself, and my wife is currently pregnant with our second child. So I'm in the trenches with my own daughter. And I'll tell you, I've seen 1-year-old children with candida overgrowth. It's so crazy. You can't believe it. They've got the thrush. They've got the yeast in their diaper. I mean, the mom can even smell the stool of the infant that has a yeasty smell to it. Mm-hmm. You've got these kids with diaper rash that doesn't go away. It's like, okay, the diaper rash is not a deficiency of diaper cream. Like, there's something going on deeper there. And unfortunately, I've seen 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, candida, bacteria, fungus. I mean, I've seen parasites, even worms. Pinworms are a huge issue as well. I've seen candida and pinworms. It'll just drive kids and moms crazy if the kids can't sleep. So just because they're young, don't put off their symptoms as less important. You know, sometimes with little kids, we're just like, oh, you're fine. It's just a tummy ache. No big deal. But it's like, wait a second, that kid's telling you something. That tummy ache could be something. So, mm-hmm. you know, investigate the kids. I had a woman with 2 5-year-old twins. they were about to get kicked out of school because of their behavioral issues. And so I said, well, let's hurry up and get some testing done. So we ran the GIMAP stool test. And what we discovered is that these children, they lived on a farm. These children had a massive amount of infections, including candida, off the charts. The mom said the kid's sweet tooth was so bad, she could hide the candy anywhere. First of all, you know, get it out of the house is the best thing. But, you know, she had some gluten-free treats and this and that in the house. She said these kids would sniff it out like a bloodhound and mm-hmm. find these treats. And they just had a ravenous appetite for sugar. And I thought, well, that's probably candida. But turns out it was parasites. It was bacteria. It was all of it. Now, back to the conversation of Clostridia bacteria. Clostridia messes up an enzyme called dopamine beta hydroxylase. And that actually breaks down your dopamine. So when you get these kids that are quote unquote ADHD or ADD, what you're going to find on the organic acid test, the bottom of the first page there is the Clostridia markers. And there's specifically one called HPHPA. And when that's elevated, that tells you that their Clostridia is impairing the breakdown of dopamine. So when you scroll down, I think it's number 33 is the dopamine marker. The dopamine levels are usually elevated or off the chart. And these kids are aggressive. They're biting other children. They've got major attitude problems. The answer is not to put them on Ritalin or some other pharmaceutical drug. The answer is to fix the Clostridia infection, probably along with candida. And then all of a sudden, you're going to see HPHPA go down. You're going to see the aggression go down. You're going to see the excess dopamine go down. And then guess what? The mom's like, hey, my kid's reborn. What did you do? All we did is fix the gut.
That's, yeah, and you absolutely hit on a huge, huge issue. And this is also where we're seeing, you know, all this autism spectrum disorders is a huge piece. And I know that GPL Labs really, and that O-test kind of grew up around testing autistic kids, there is such a huge, huge problem behind behavior when the gastrointestinal tract is totally messed up. So I'm just so glad that you're also helping to address that. We have Dr. Maya Shetreat, who wrote a book called The Dirt Cure. She's a pediatric neurologist and an integrative medicine and functional medicine doc, as one of our interviewees. And she has a lot of very specific pointers also that we can do with children. But I think you really hit a lot of nails that why are we seeing all these behavioral disorders in our kids? And a lot of it has to do with the food, the sugar, the food supply, and the lot of antibiotics and plenty of other things that they're getting too early in life. Ask if mom took antibiotics while she was pregnant. Did she get a breast infection while nursing and got put on antibiotics? And there's, by the way, there's other ways to treat the breast infections and candida and thrush in pregnant ladies other than using antibiotics. So
yeah, olive leaf is probably one of my favorite and probably most safest remedies for women. Obviously, you know, consult your practitioner, make sure they agree. But olive leaf is something that's been pretty tried and true and is safe for breastfeeding as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. And, you know, one of the things that I know that I learned from Dr. Shaw, why candida is so hard to get rid of, it has to do with it actually, the little fingers of it actually penetrate the cells like grapple hooks. And that is one of the reasons that it's so hard to get rid of. And then kind of like Lyme, it'll go into a cyst protective form. And I'm sure you can elaborate on that. And one of the reasons that we may want to use pulse therapy. So let's before we talk about what the therapies, just some other symptoms that you'll see that can be related to yeast or fungal overgrowth.
Sure.
Kind of from head to toe.
Honestly, it could be pretty much anything that you just don't feel right. I mean, come on, Evan, how corny are you now? You're saying anything and everything's candida, but I'm not joking. It literally could be. So if we go head to toe, I mean, it could be, let's start at the scalp, for example. Let's talk about all these kids and adults with what we call cradle cap or what we call basically a skin infection, so to speak. It's almost like it's candida manifesting on the scalp.
Yeah.
Or dandruff. Yeah, exactly. So you'll look and you could see it in your kids. You know, they may have like this yellow, flaky looking scalp. That's a sign something's off. Further on, you could go into the hair. You know, some women are saying that their hair is not as thick or it's falling out. I mean, that could be many things. That could be an anemia issue. That could be ferritin problems. That could be mineral absorption, but it could be infection, right? Underlying infection, not absorbing nutrients, therefore bad hair. We could go on to the eyes. You know, sometimes people with candida complain of floaters or other vision disturbances. We can go into the brain. We could talk about the brain fog. Candida produces a toxin called acetaldehyde, which is very similar to alcohol. And this is why people that have very high levels of candida that I've seen, they feel a little bit drunk all the time. They're just a little bit off kilter. Their balance may be off. They may have balance issues. They may have memory problems and think that they have Parkinson's or some other neurodegenerative disease because their brain fog is so bad. I know you're my best friend, but I can't remember your name. That could just be candida. I walked into this room. Why am I in here again? Where did I put my keys again? Where's my wallet? Dang it. That could be candida. We could go to the tongue. You could see the thrush on the tongue. It could be a white coating. You could go to your teeth. You know, a lot of times with gut issues, I've seen gums, like receding gum issues that get better once we fix the gut. We could go into the chest. It could be chest pain, which I've heard people with mold have chest pain. Mm-hmm. It could be heart palpitations because when these toxins are releasing things into the bloodstream, it's an adrenal stressor. So I had heart palpitations when I had my gut issues. It could be anxiety. That's a big one. It could be cramping, obviously bloating, looking pregnant, distended belly. It could be that you get full really easily or you're just not able to eat a lot of food. Appetite could be changed, usually decreased appetite. It could be changes with your bowels, could be constipation or diarrhea. Some of these bad guys increase the speed of the gut motility. Some of these bad guys slow down the gut motility. So it could be either or. I would say probably most common is constipation rather than diarrhea. I would say if we go down to the joints, maybe some knee pain. Mm-hmm. I've heard of joint pain issues being related to this as well. Ankle pain, any type of quote unquote arthritis. It may not be arthritis. Mm-hmm. It may be some type of infection. There's one we test for on the stool called Prevotella. That is a big trigger for rheumatoid arthritis. It's called Prevotella copri. Just Google Prevotella rheumatoid arthritis. 75% of people diagnosed with RA actually have a Prevotella infection. If you just get rid of that bacteria, the RA goes away. It could be sleep issues as well. Mm-hmm. I think that's enough.
Yeah, vaginal yeast infections, jock itch, fungal toe infections.
Those are super important. Yeah, the athlete's foot, mm-hmm. that could be it too.
Yeah. So, and a lot of, you know, guys get the jock itch and the women get the yeast infections either vaginally or they'll get them underneath their breasts or in kind of folds in their skin. So we've hit a lot of symptoms. And now let's get into, what are the treatments? Where do you start? We've had a lot of folks talking about diet, but I'm sure you probably have your own focus on that. And then what are some of the nutrients? And then we'll talk a little bit about Herxheimer's response. And I actually wanted to come back around before we get on there about alcohol and talk about alcoholism and just craving for alcohol. And you absolutely hit the nail on the head. There's an auto brewery phenomenon, which is going on where, if you think about what is alcohol anyway, well, it's yeast and grains mixed together with some liquid and that's how you create it. So if you have a big fungal overgrowth in the gastrointestinal tract and you're feeding it a bunch of sugar and you're feeding it grains, you can make your own alcohol. And we've talked about this with Doug Kaufman and again, how it's part of what can drive alcohol cravings. And then the alcohol itself is further creating a gut problem, more stress on your liver, and those fungi are craving that alcohol. So that's a big piece if you're trying to recover from the disease of alcoholism. That I hope you're all paying attention because this is part of it. So
and a lot of these guys, you know, guys are more stubborn for some reason than women in terms of like getting rid of the alcohol. Women are like, yeah, I'll quit the wine ASAP, you know, but guys like, oh, I can't have my beer. It's like, if you want to pay me to tell you not to drink beer every time we talk, I'm happy to tell you that. But if you just stop now, you're going to save me so much. You're going to save my breath. If you just stop it now, we're going to get you better faster. If you get rid of it, you know, it's just in terms of the, so I'll transition that little rant into about the diet piece. You know, some argue there's like a candida diet or something that you need to follow. Honestly, you should be eating, you know, and some people say, oh, if you have cancer, you should eat a cancer diet. If you have this disease, you should eat this disease diet. It's like, you should basically be eating an anti-candida, anti-cancer diet all of your life, which is good organic meats, good organic vegetables, some berries. I don't go too crazy with the fruits with people, especially if there's a problem. I mean, look, if you're in New York City and it's February and there's a foot of snow on the ground, there's no pineapples growing. Don't eat pineapple in February in New York. Like mangoes, dried mango chips, like there's no mangoes growing in New York City or you know, Michigan. So I try to eat a seasonal diet. You know, I go to the farmers markets and I figure out, even if I'm going to end up buying it somewhere else, I'll look and see, okay, there's pumpkins growing. Maybe it's time to eat pumpkins. Okay, there's squash. Maybe it's time to eat squash. Oh, there's broccoli. Maybe I should eat some broccoli. So I try to live with the seasons. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, you can't go wrong that way. But you just have to make sure you're doing as much organic as you can, because we know that even parts per billion, PPB, of pesticides is enough to kill beneficial bacteria in the gut. So here you are taking all these expensive probiotics and other good supplements, but you're still eating conventional food. Or maybe you only buy organic almond milk, but all of your vegetables are still conventional, aka chemical, and you're killing all the good bacteria. You're kind of wasting your money. So if you're not 100% organic at your house, that should be your goal. Now, if you go to a restaurant, it's probably not organic, and you just have to accept that reality. And if you enjoy going out to restaurants and that's part of your thing, then do it. But just know that every time you eat, there's no such thing as a neutral food. As my friend Dr. Rodney Ford said, he's a pediatric gastro doc. He said, every time you eat, you're either helping your health or you're hurting your health. There is no neutral food that you can just get away with and it's just filler. No, it's either good or it's not good.
Absolutely. And we have Jeffrey Smith from responsibletechnology.org. He's the guru behind genetically modified foods and knowledge around glyphosate and Roundup, and why that is such a huge problem and how we've altered our entire microbiome of the soil of the planet as well as ourselves. And so thank you for really mentioning that, why organic is such an important piece of the diet. And yeah, and there's a lot of riffs that we can do on different dietary plans, but can we have different folks speaking to that? And part of it depends on, are you super high histamine? Are you really trying to go after mitochondrial? That we can tweak and adjust the diet. But I think the number one thing is what you said, is trying to go to an organic diet. So let's talk about, I did want to touch back on the gut issues, and a lot of SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, is also really CFO, fungal overgrowth. And so I just wanted to just have you elaborate that on a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, it's in the literature too. You know, if you just type in CIFO, S-I-F-O, or you type in small intestinal fungal overgrowth, what we're finding is that a lot of these people that thought they had SIBO with bacteria, you know, over half of the cases, it's CFO, it's fungus that's growing upstream in the small intestine. So, you know, like I said, if you go to a SIBO specialist, they're going to say you have SIBO, but that might not be true. So yeah. Now, does it actually change the game plan that much? In my experience, not really. I don't care so much about the location of the bad guys. I just care to prove that they're there. We know they're in this giant tube somewhere from your mouth to your anus. There's bad guys somewhere along the way. We've got to fix them. So for me, if I see, or we think, hey, based on these symptoms, excess burping or bloating or whatever, hey, this is probably small intestinal. It's not that I'm going to do this protocol versus that one. I'm still going to use similar herbs to take care of it.
Mm-hmm. So what herbs are those? What are your favorites of?
Yeah. So I've got a custom formula I've worked on called Microbiome Support Number 3. This is like my go-to. Now, of course, there's like 100 different herbs that I'm sure we can talk about. But if I'm specifically going after some type of bacteria, some type of candida or fungus, or maybe even viruses, or a combination of all of it, I try to kill as many birds with the same stone as I can. So rather than use this herb for candida, this one for this one for that, I try to combine everything and then just hit it together. So the Microbiome 3, this is like French tarragon leaf. This is thyme, just like you cook with. This is Paul D'Arco, which is one of my favorites. It's a bark. Stinging nettle, which is a root, works really good. Olive leaf, which I mentioned. I wouldn't use this specific formula for pregnant or breastfeeding women, but olive leaf by itself, I would. Tenospora, that's another ingredient. The Latin is called Tenospora cordifolia. We use the stem and the root of that, and it's all in a capsule form. And depending on the level of overgrowth, we may do just one capsule of this, maybe once or twice per day, like one cap breakfast, one cap dinner. Or sometimes we go all the way up to 6 capsules, 2 breakfast, 2 lunch, 2 dinner. And there's usually other things in the picture as well. Maybe some oregano, maybe some garlic. Garlic is a wonderful, specifically the allicin, the mm-hmm. patented version of the garlic that's on the market. I don't know the exact equivalent, but it's like 20 cloves of garlic per capsule or something. It's something ridiculously effective that kills fungus and parasites. So it's usually a combo. It could be olive, it could be garlic, could be oregano, and then it could be some of the microbiome support herbs.
Yeah, well, you've touched on a lot of really important herbal approaches, and you can also use essential oils to hit some of those. But it is nice when you have that synergistic blend and the synergistic combination. We use a similar kind of synergistic that's going after viruses, parasites, fungus, and all that. And what about pulsing? I mean, that's something that I've learned how to do. And that's important. And particularly when you're looking at the SIBO, SIFO, we're seeing a lot of times paralysis of the migrating motor complex. These toxins are inhibiting the part of the the nervous system in the gut, which is giving the information to push things along. And one of the reasons why it can be helpful to pulse therapies. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I don't know if your version of pulse is different than my version of pulse, but what I just have people do, mm-hmm. and this is not all the time. Some people, we just go 7 days in, mm-hmm. but some people will have them do 5 days on, 2 days off. Like we'll have them take the weekends off, mm-hmm. or some people will do 3 full weeks. So 21 days, 777, and then we'll have them take 7 days off. Or sometimes we have people go straight for 6 weeks and then they take 2 weeks off, and then we go another 6 weeks and then 2 weeks off. So there's never really any black or white for me, or this is right, this is wrong. Sometimes I just have an intuition that says, hey, maybe we, you know, maybe this lady needs some extra biofilm support. So maybe we're going to throw in like some, a monolaurin, which is a coconut extract with lauric acid. It's a good biofilm buster. Maybe we're going to throw in interphase mm-hmm. or some serrapeptidase or some other enzymes to break down biofilm. Maybe this lady needs a little extra of that. So sometimes I'm just driven by intuition. I always try to focus on the data first. But that's kind of my version of pulsing. I don't know how that compares to what you're talking about, though.
Again, it's similar. I think, you know, part of it is individualized, but we know that with a lot of these bacteria and parasites, again, if you hit them really hard for too long and you keep going, they'll shrink and hide, kind of like Lyme does. Again, Candida will do the same thing. And so you want to hit it hard for a little while and then give it a break and let them come out before you come back and kind of hit again. And again, you touched on a lot of important ways to break down biofilm, to break down the fungal capsules. Interphase is something that we use. Ozonated olive oil is another one. And
I've seen that. I have not used it. How does it work? It worked pretty good.
So again, and that's just something that we've just started incorporating into our system. But ozone in general, and there are definitely some more advanced therapies for folks who've been really super sick, and we can use some advanced antifungals. I see a lot of very seriously immunocompromised folks. But we have to be very careful, about killing a bunch of stuff off before the body is ready and supporting it. So let's talk about Herxheimer's and that Herxheimer's reaction and how you manage that. And what is the Herxheimer's reaction?
Yeah, well, my opinion of it is that it should be very minimal or almost non-existent. So the Herxheimer, some people call it a die-off or a detox reaction. My opinion of what it is that the body is getting overburdened. It can't keep up with how much stuff you're killing. And so imagine that you've got a gigantic flow of water as big as a fire hose, but you're trying to push all that water through a water hose that's the size of a penny. I mean, it's too much flowing. Or you've got a hose, and then at the end of the hose, you've got a golf ball, and it's stuck. And these toxins that you're killing, they're building up in the system and you can't get them out. So that's kind of my idea of what it is and why it could happen. I believe several reasons. You know, I think one, it could be that you're killing too fast. Mm-hmm. So maybe instead of taking herbs 3 times a day, you need to do twice a day. Or instead of twice a day, you do once a day. Or maybe the adrenals were too weak and you were supposed to support this person's adrenal glands and their liver and their kidneys and the lymphatic system first for maybe 3-4 weeks before you start killing. You know, sometimes the killing protocols go flawless and I can start people simultaneously with adrenal support and gut support and liver support. Sometimes they say, hey, I've got headaches or I've got this or this that's getting worse. I'm like, okay, hold on, press the pause button. First of all, we're going to cut the dosage down by half. If that's not enough, cut it more. Mm-hmm. Bump up the adrenals, bump up the liver, bump up your kidney support, drink more water. go to bed earlier. And then usually we add in the full dose of herbs back in and they're fine again.
What about binders? Are you having them do binders?
It depends on how bad or how long that they've been sick. But Jay Davidson, he's got a few good products that we use. We've got some of his stuff that's got the fulvic acid in there. We do use some of the GI detox formulas that have like a little bit of clay in there, or the activated charcoal can be really helpful. I don't use it all the time though. 100% of the time I don't use it. As long as people are peeing, they're pooping, you know, at least once a day, hopefully twice a day they're pooping. Generally speaking, you don't have to use them, but it does help. It is a really good like bonus, you know, I do find for some people. And then, so like I said, I think it should be minimal to non-existent. If it does happen, I think that the protocol was either too hard, it was too fast, it was too strong, or you just weren't ready. So in my opinion, that is a red flag for you. That doesn't mean, hey, you feel like crap. That means you just need to weakness, or what do they say? Like in the military, pain is weakness leaving the body. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with that. If something's not right and your body's telling you something's not right, that doesn't mean hit it harder. Right. That means, hold on. Let's pull back the reins. Let's look around left and right. Okay, what's going on? Oh, after we added in that supplement, that's when this Herxheimer started. Okay, let's pull that supplement back out. Let's bump this supplement up. How much water are you drinking? Oh, I drink 2 cups of coffee in the morning. Oh, well, you're dehydrated. Let's switch you to tea and then bump up the water. You know, we try to mitigate it because no Herx reaction is caused from the same thing. It could be a million different things that are changing, and you just have to have a bird's eye view, I guess, really. You use a bird's eye view at first, but then you zoom in with the microscope to make sure you don't miss something big, like, hey, they had 16 ounces of coffee in the morning and then they felt like crap.
Absolutely. Well, you've touched on a wealth of very important information on how to do this. And we have talked to a number of the other practitioners here about, again, doing it in layers, opening the lymphatics first, get the liver draining well and processing before you start tacking and killing off things in very large numbers and overwhelming the system. And you talked about, again, we can use charcoal and other binders to help bind up some of those toxins from the die-off. We can use things like trisalts that'll help to neutralize the response. And then we do a lot of different IV therapies and advanced therapies for, again, some of the really sick folks. So those are all another resources. Well, Evan, you are just an absolute wealth of information. You've got a powerful story. You're such a great coach, and you really like to help folks on how do you do this kind of on your own if you don't have somebody who's knowledgeable. And unfortunately, there's, you know, we're trying to get the word out here and really get people knowledgeable. So where can they find you?
Yeah, they can just Google my name. You could just type in Evan Brand, like brand name, or if you just go to the site, evanbrand.com. I encourage people to check out the podcast. It's free. I've been doing the podcast, every single week for 6 years. So I'm kind of like a grandpa in the podcast world. Not many people were doing like functional health podcasts in 2012. So there's almost 300 episodes. It's all free. I'm sure you can deep dive in. I interview people like you and other practitioners, and so check it out. And then if they want to reach out, I'm virtual. So I do just Skype and phone and FaceTime consults, which is pretty cool because I can help people everywhere in the world. And all this testing you can do at your house. Now, IVs and all the cool stuff you're doing, I can't do that.
Right. Yeah.
But all the testing I can do anywhere around the world. So if you need help, feel free to reach out, and look forward to talking with people soon.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for the great work that you're doing, and just also showing how somebody who took a very difficult journey and turned it around and has now turned it into something really positive, hopeful, and reaching out and helping others. And I think that is part of the moral of this story, is that your body is able to heal itself. You can get well. And when you have a mission and purpose in life, you turn around and you're serving others.
Amen. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast, and I hope this has helped people.